The day is November 22nd, 1983. This is the next to the last lecture in a series of lectures by Roger Weir on the Enlightenment. Tonight's lecture is entitled Mozart, who lived 1756 to 1827, the famous composer and interpreter of the Enlightenment.
We now come in the series to the last figure in the Enlightenment. Mozart is the end of the Enlightenment. His death in late 1791 closes out the Enlightenment. He is the tragic hero of the Enlightenment, and the misunderstanding of Mozart's place and personality carries on to our own day, as you can see very well. It was written recently in a book on Don Giovanni. In a certain sense, there is something superhuman in Mozart's work. Probably it is that there is something miraculous for us in what he has to say. Mozart does indeed perform a miracle, and it is hardly surprising that it is difficult for most men to hear it. As Bruno Walter has so well said, the false Mozart was invented by those superficial people who, deaf to the things of the spirit, turned Mozart's virtues against Mozart himself, who made of the power of light a glittering adornment and rendered invisible the secret grief. Mozart has been laid open to censure by his own admirers. For too long has admiration stood between his work and its true understanding. The lucidity and painful conflict of our own epoch, the 20th century, was necessary before Mozart could reappear in the guise this time of an archangel. Mozart is one of the most misunderstood figures in Western history, and in fact the misunderstanding of Mozart's life and work and place is an index to the superficiality of the so-called literate culture of Western civilization. The false, pretentious, willfully propagated misunderstanding is the clearest indictment I know of the inconsequentiality of popular modern culture since the Enlightenment. The true understanding of Mozart gave rise, as no other figure in Europe that we could point to gave rise to, the Age of Revolution. There were revolutions before the American Revolution, having commenced as early as 1776 and culminated itself in 1788, and the French coming along in 1789. But it is truly the figure of Mozart who, like a true depth gauge, gives us the pressure of the time. And as he ends the Enlightenment with his own life, he begins the Age of Revolution, which we still live in. Mozart, in fact, is a peculiar figure still in Western history. Recently, 2 years ago, the Grove Encyclopedia of Music and Musicians was revised substantially, rewritten, and out of its wonderful, expensive, multi-volumed extent, several biographies of book length were culled and published just a few months ago. The New Grove Mozart, which I have by the editor of the Grove encyclopedia, Stanley Sadie, is a case in point. We have within the 250 pages of this massive biography of Mozart all of the detail we would ever wish to know about the inconsequential musical data aspects of Mozart's life and nothing whatsoever of his spirit. I am reminded in reading this latest gloss of world-class so-called scholarship of the great two-volume, thousand-page biography of William Faulkner by Joseph Blattner, wherein we were given to understand that in between trips to the hospital to dry out from bouts of alcoholism, Faulkner managed to write 20 of the world's greatest novels. In this biography of Mozart, we are given a collection of notations that belong not even on the back of record jackets to describe the contents within, as if one were reading a description of a fine souffle in terms of the ingredients that went into the souffle, and thereby we would understand what cooking was. And so we must, even though we must base ourselves upon the musical information given us, we must recut and recast the figure of Mozart and stress again his importance. We began in this course with the titanic revolution in human thought wrought by the perceptions and conceptions of Leibniz and Newton. We found major figure after major figure bringing before us increasingly the pace of discovery of the capacity of man's mind. And we have not noted, perhaps as much as we should have, how the so-called upper classes and intelligentsia that flourished under the increasingly fine conditions of life and refined conditions of mind grew astray from the very times in which they lived. It has been estimated that the French nobility numbered about 140,000 people. 5 out of every 1,000 Frenchmen was a noble in the Enlightenment, all of them filled with pretensions. Less than 1% of those were able to financially carry off the lifestyle which they pretended to. This was the condition of Europe increasingly in the 18th century. And when we may cite a dozen of the world's finest minds within the century, we note increasingly sociologically that the split between the haves and have-nots grew apace, so that the revolutionary end of the century comes as no surprise, but in fact a long-delayed sigh of relief that mankind, by and large, had not lost contact with reality. The conditions were increasingly absurd. And if there is a characteristic to the Enlightenment in the popular mind, it is the absurdity of intelligent human beings in white powdered wigs, in court costumes, uttering banalities to each other, while the mobs in the streets in Paris at the time of the end of Mozart's life were pulling down the iron bars, the windows, the chandeliers, and the people themselves. Mozart, in this way, is for us the true beacon to understand the end of the Enlightenment, and the figure for whom we will have to refer when we begin the Age of Revolution, for his musical inheritor was not Brunetti, who became Kapellmeister, but was Ludwig von Beethoven, who used the musical legacy left by Mozart to create the musical understanding and interpretation of the Age of Revolution, the era superciliously styled in retrospect by our own time as the Romantic era, as if man's search for freedom is ever some cultural epoch which can safely be designated to chapters within textbooks. We find, therefore, Mozart as the poignant, tragical figure in Western history. There never is, in any era of Western history, a figure more maligned by misrepresentation than Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The common supposition that the portraits that we have of the costumed, bewigged, gentle little figure who wrote spry music that one could place in the background of dainty conversations is totally inaccurate. And therefore I urge you to cast it forth from your image base, never again to appeal to it. Who was Mozart? Who in fact was he? Who in fact was this figure whose life ends the Enlightenment, brings to a close the ordered quest for reality, and ushers in an age when man, destitute of finding a quiet, ordered way, resorts to cannons both on the field of battle, on the pages of music, in the texts of literature, in the very personalities themselves. And we will get to the Age of Revolution in April, May, and June of next year. Mozart, as a person, came into the world in 1756, early in the year, January 27th. Already by 1756, we are acquainted with the activities of Rousseau, Diderot, Voltaire. Europe was seething. But in 1756, it was still within the intellectual realm, the theoretical appraisal of great minds. They were assessing by the envisioning capacity of the refined mind the future developments of man, and increasingly we find those that we've treated with by the late 1750s were surveying future history in terms of what it in fact did become: a battlefield of ideas populated in the 1750s by pens and populated in the 1790s by cannon. His father, Leopold, was a very fine musician who played concerts continuously, especially in his native city of Salzburg. At this time, Salzburg in Austria occupied a very unique position in the Central European realm. Imagine in your mind a line drawn somewhere across the map of Europe, ended by the great cities of Vienna on the east and Munich on the west. Then, in your mind, draw a triangle with the apex at Prague at the very top, with Munich and Vienna at the other vortices, and continuing with the idea of a triangle, draw a triangle in your mind, south, with the apex reaching down to Milan. Now you have a great diamond shape with Prague, Vienna, Milan, and Munich. In the very center of this diamond, on the line of demarcation, is the Austrian city of Linz. And if one were to take Linz to Munich, about halfway, just a little to the south, would be Salzburg. And even though it was not geographically in the center, it was musically in the center of this world. Mozart and his older sister, older by about 6 years, were the only children that lived. I think there were 7 or 8 children born to Leopold and his wife. They were the only ones that survived. The mother also was quite musical. But Leopold was seized with the idea that his son was perhaps a musical gift from the divine. And from the crib raised Mozart as if he were, in fact, a musical genius. It is one of those fortunate cases that the baby turned out to be exactly what the parents expected. The only other case that I'm familiar with on this order of genius was the mother of Frank Lloyd Wright, who, when she brought young Frank Lloyd Wright home to his crib, decorated his room with great prints of the Gothic cathedrals. And when asked why, she said, "This is the world's greatest architect, and he needs from birth to view the best that man has made in architecture." The young Mozart was treated the same way. The father, from birth, would hold the baby Wolfgang on his lap. When he would play at the piano, he would hum to him. And so Mozart came into the world to song and music, composition and order. His first musical compositions, which are in the autograph of his father, we have them because Leopold sent them to the British Museum, were at the age of 4. The man who cataloged all of Mozart's works, a man named Kirchel, K-O-C-H-E-L, Kirchel lists some of these very early works by the young child Mozart. His father then took the young Amadeus and his older sister on concert tours by the age of 5. And the young Mozart was viewed as an extraordinary prodigy. That is to say, they would go to various towns. Usually they would pick some destination, say like Munich, and they would try and hit the towns in between that would have concert halls or would expose the children to people of importance, people of royalty. When they would come into these towns before the concert, the musical personages of that community would come to ooh and ah over the young Mozart, and they would test him. And as he grew a little older, the test became more and more severe, increasingly complicated and ingenious. And always Mozart astonished the elders with his capacities. In fact, we know from retrospect and from Mozart's own letters that he had one of the greatest minds of all time in terms of its photographic memory capacity. Mozart not only had a photographic mind, but he had a sound-based photographic mind. That is to say, he could hear a musical composition for the first time, and by the time he was able to write music, by the time he was 11 or 12, he could go home and write down the music that he had heard, note for note, completely. This capacity, this extraordinary mind of Mozart, makes him the ultimate prodigy of the Enlightenment. For, as we will see, he was increasingly aware that the phenomenal world offered no solace whatsoever to him. The world of society, the world of economics, the world of personal relationships was increasingly understood to be a quicksand where there was no stability whatsoever for Mozart, even to the last day of his life. The stability for Mozart's personality, the region where he was king, in fact styled appropriately for that region the Sun King, was the mind. And Mozart, as he grew, realized that for him the reality of this world was his mind and not his life as a phenomenal being. And so he cheerfully, seemingly, gave his life over to his father to manipulate, gave his circumstances over to others to manipulate, and consequently never developed even the rudimentary concerns with keeping track of his finances, with keeping track of his health, and of his own emotional capacities. He never gave it a second thought that he would have to portion himself out in terms of the phenomenal world, economically, socially, physically. Mozart lived almost completely within the mental realm, whose language for him was not mathematics, but its sister science, music. And just as Leibniz and Newton had mastered the invisible realm expressed through mathematics, Mozart closed out the age begun by them in the same realm, mastering it, portioning it out in terms of music. And the musical form of Mozart is the artistic expression of the mathematical mind of Leibniz and Newton. And so we may parenthetically group together Leibniz and Newton and Mozart and say that within this expressive historical development lies the phenomenon known as the Enlightenment. Outside of it, forwards or backwards, we have different conditions, different capacities that are stressed. Within it, the capacity that reigns supreme is the world of the mind and its capacities, transcendental, universal. And so, just as the calculus and physics of Leibniz and Newton operate universally within the realms for which they were intended, Mozart's music also is a universal form. Wherever music in the capacity of our hearing range will manifest itself, Mozart's music will bring that form to its perfection. There are other musical forms to be developed and were developed, but within the forms chosen by Mozart, he brought them to perfection. That is to say, he brought them to a point where they will never again be capable of further development that the styles of the forms had to change. the Baroque Piano Concerto, the Baroque Symphony, the Baroque Opera, were all brought to perfection by Mozart in the sense of a mathematical genius bringing an equation to its perfection. And when you have the equation perfect, there is no need to go back and redo it. All of the problems have been solved. The form has been achieved complete. We begin now to have a more just assessment for the incredible capacities of Mozart. His father, Leopold, tried three times to take Mozart south to Italy. Three times he tried to take him, did take him to Milano, tried to get him appointments there. In fact, was awarded a very special decoration called the Golden Spur. I think I have the date in here. Yes. In Rome, in 1770, Mozart was awarded the Papal Order of the Golden Spur. And his order was that of knight. In other words, he was 14 years old, and the Pope in Rome conferred upon him a rather mystical position in the order of the Golden Spur. Mozart's father understood this as a decoration, because usually the nobles and the royalty would give to the Mozart people not so much florins, cash, but they would give them watches to sell, or other accoutrements to sell, so that the Mozarts, then coming home from a tour, would have all of this regalia to sell at the pawnbrokers and then obtain money for that and live on the money. This touring, even though they were held in good esteem while the public was in contact with them, this touring was viewed by the nobility, expressly written by some letters of Marie Therese, that the Mozarts were like a little band of beggars going from city to city to take what handouts they could have. In fact, one of the portraits of Mozart in the court costume was lent to him and his family so that they would look halfway decent for the performance. Later on, when Mozart sought to have a position from the son of Maria Theresa, she wrote to him, "Have nothing to do with these people. They are just a pack of beggars." Even later, when Mozart was mature, writing some of the world's greatest music, he was seated at a table in Vienna, somewhat above the cooks, but below the valets. This peculiar schizophrenic break with reality occurs again in our own time. The lack of judgment is colossal. The lack of appreciation for this circumstance is outrageous. The father, misunderstanding the young Wolfgang, seeing him only as a musical prodigy, someone for whom he could earn a better living. He wanted the best for his son, that's true, as a father would, so that he could make his way in the world and they could all as a family prosper together. The patrons of these people, even worse, viewing music as some ornament, some adornment, which one had for occasions, and musicians rather like the mariachis that populate Mexican restaurants in Los Angeles. Mozart was seen on this level. Is it any wonder that people responsible for this kind of a view of culture and civilization were dragged from their beds within a few years and murdered publicly in the streets by the thousands? They were so divorced from reality, from a just appraisal of what life in its natural and in its mental capacities actually means, that they were incapable of seeing Mozart. The fact is, though, that we have again come to the same impasse. Mozart again is viewed as a decoration, his music seen as a public entertainment, and some jot like Così fan tutti, which he wrote just to survive, is seen as a very delightful representation of Mozart's work. Whereas something extraordinary like Don Giovanni or like the Magic Flute are almost impossible to find. We went around today in Los Angeles from record store to record store, and only one store in all of Los Angeles had a copy of the Magic Flute, Mozart's last work in his greatest opera. So we have come again to the same impasse. Will we be dragged from our beds? I'm afraid perhaps some will, perhaps not ourselves. It is not so much nuclear war that needs to be feared in our time. It's the inanity of the culture that has grown so divorced from life that very, very few thinking people any longer endorse it or would be willing to shed tears for its demise. These conditions occurred increasingly as the 18th century drew to its last decade, and Mozart will die in December, early December of 1791, 35 years of age. By the time he was awarded the Golden Spur, the knight level, by the Pope, he had already begun to envision himself in a way totally different from that externally foisted upon him, but realized that there was no hope for him to change his circumstances, because the vast gulf that occurred to the young genius at 14, the vast gulf between what his mind could conceive clearly and what his life represented in appearance, was a gulf too large to bridge. That is to say, Mozart began to live within inside himself as if he were a mutant in an alien society. We find Mozart from the age of 15 on increasingly concerned with developing his capacities as a musical composer rather than as a musical player. He is no longer someone who will just give concerts, but he is someone for whom composition becomes the portioning out of reality. An extraordinary example of this: Mozart was taken at the age of 15 to London, and there he met C.E. Bach. And within 2 weeks was able to compose a musical work that showed a complete mastery of the older Bach style. That is to say, it's an indication of stupendous analytical capacity on the level of prodigy and genius. The young Mozart was able not only to hear and understand, but to analyze, dissect, and recreate exactly the complex style of one of the most illustrious members of the Bach family. Mozart's compositions from the London visit begin to show his playing with form on a scale of no longer just a child genius, but of a world-class mind. He, in fact, begins to entertain for himself a future which has very little to do with what his father was outlining for him. One of the first indications of this, when he is 19 years old, he executed his first extended essay in dramatic music. And it was a dialogue between a Christian spirit and a worldly spirit. In other words, there was a dialogue of words and music to go with it, of a contest, a struggle between the world spirit and the divine spirit. There was no commission for this work. It came from Mozart, the man. He became extremely interested in the problem of sacred song, especially as we would understand it today, in extended oratorio. That is, not simply to write arias to be sung by prima donnas, but by the musical form leading to an expression of sacred tension and its resolution within this rarefied, purified level of mental musical form, which geared itself phenomenally to an expression of the resolution in terms of human life. But the emphasis was that the order of the universe occurs in the mind and not in the phenomenal world. That the ordering of music, like the ordering of mathematics, will allow he who commands this order to portion out the phenomenal world in terms of that order, so that Mozart becomes, at this time, 18 or 19, a pioneer in that realm which was to be the glory of Western civilization. The control of the mind in its formal portioning out of reality ensures almost inevitably, if not automatically, a control of the material world. If you control the mind, you control the world. The arena for Mozart was to understand the tension between the worldly spirit and the divine spirit, that this was in fact the dialogue that man must, in a formal sense, master the intricacies of. We find then that by the time this has settled into him, as Stanley Sadie writes, some biographers have suggested a personal romantic crisis at this time. In other words, they notice a sea change in the quality and the purpose to Mozart's composing. And so, like a clumsy material-based assessor, they say, well, he must have had some crisis inside. This is how foolish things continue to be. But musically, and I'm sorry, I don't have examples here. I simply did not have the music available to record. But musical examples could be played for you and could show that at this time, in fact, Mozart begins to change his musical form radically and rapidly. By 1775, the following year. He wrote from April to December 5 violin concertos, which show an increasing quantum jump in comprehension. That is to say, his mastery of musical form jumps into the world-class universal professional level, and his control of the ordering of human feeling within this musical form jumps to a universal level. The 5 violin concertos of 1775 are as important as the Declaration of Independence the next year in world history. They signal that the comprehension of transcendental form and its bridging to the comprehension of human feeling was understood by a human being. That is to say, the mind and the feeling capacities of a human being were ordered to a level that had not been seen in the world to that point in the West. Mozart, almost as if sensing that he had mastered this particular development, would write only one more piece for violin and orchestra before he died. That is, in the remaining 12 years of his life, he would only once again essay something which has been styled Sinfonia Concertante, but it is in fact a double concerto for violin and viola and orchestra, which takes to new heights the capacity for the human spirit to feel in areas that had not been available to it before. That is to say, Mozart, having completed a mastery of musical form and feeling capacity, form, in 1775, a few years later, in writing the Sinfonia Concertante, Kirchhoff 364, would introduce a new feeling capacity, one which can only be styled as mystical triumph on an individual level. This was not an angelic gracefulness being bestowed upon a man. It was not some universal religious form conveying its imprimatur of mystical grace upon a man. It was an individual man conceiving in his own mind forms that had never been conceived before, and freeing himself to feel feelings on an individual level, personal level, that had never been felt before. Mozart was opening up a whole new era in human civilization, and it is with the jump of Mozart's music that the romantic hero comes into being, because it is the music of Mozart that creates the first conditions in the world wherein such a hero could find sustenance and nourishment and live and breathe.
Without Mozart's excursion in the 5 violin concertos of 1775 and the Sinfonia Concertante, the double concerto later on, there would in all likelihood not have been
Mozart that creates the first conditions in the world wherein such a hero could find sustenance and nourishment and live and breathe. Without Mozart's excursions in the 5 violin concertos of 1775, in the Sinfonia Concertante, the double concerto later on, there would in all likelihood not have been a 5th symphony of Beethoven, much less a 9th symphony of Beethoven. We find, therefore, very curious situation. Mozart was 19 years old. He had never left his father, The first time he ever left his father was when he was 22 years of age. He went on a tour with his mother. He had never been out of his father's iron hand kin. He'd always been the dutiful son. He'd always been the prodigy, passing the tests that they gave him, making the concerts, doing the recitals. And yet, underneath this ornamental overlay, a whole new structure of the mind had been developed. A whole new adventurous capacity for feeling had been not only imagined, but brought into manifestation. But genius is peculiar. It is not seen very often in its own time. The contemporaries of genius rarely see what is before them. It took 300 years for Shakespeare to be appreciated in his full stature. These experiments were seen as musical toyings of a brilliant mind, not really to be considered seriously, something to listen to of an afternoon and then pass on. There were other things to do, or other compositions to hear. But not so for Mozart himself. He is the tragic hero of the Enlightenment. He was the only man who could appreciate the poignancy of the new threshold of consciousness attained. He was, in fact, in terms of the world in which he moved, one of the only sane men that he knew. His mind had no wig and no powder upon it. He was taken 1778 to Paris. He was introduced around. He made friends with a number of individuals there. He realized increasingly that the Enlightenment had meant for him a very particular, poignant realization that there were other minds like his own, other human beings like himself, and what they were pointing to was the struggle for human freedom, for liberty in the material world, and what was a difficulty to them was grasping some formal way, some language which would move masses of people. The wonderful literary writings of Voltaire or Hume or Kant reached the few, the intelligentsia, the friends, the philosophes, but it didn't bridge and reach the masses. It would be Mozart, through his music, that would take the ideas, the avalanche of realizations of the Enlightenment, and put it into the hands of the millions. And in fact, one of the very first examples of this came in a peculiar way. He was acquainted with the French Enlightenment production of Beaumarchais' The Barber of Seville. So he wrote a musical opera using all of his tremendous musical form engendered, and wrote an opera called The Marriage of Figaro. Now Figaro is written in 1785. And it's 1784. Its first production was, in fact, in Paris. And it's one of the few works of Mozart that, from the first, was a smash success. And we have to emphasize smash. Figaro spread throughout Europe like wildfire. It brought into the concert hall thousands and tens of thousands of individuals for whom the marriage of Figaro became the rallying cry. It had put into music, into a musical form, both in terms of the opera, in terms of the plot of the opera, the libretto of the opera, the music of the opera. It became an experience of liberation on a mass movement scale. Mozart would at this time travel, and wherever he would go, he would write in his letters, "The town has become Figaro mad." He went to Prague, which he enjoyed immensely, and he said, "All of Prague, the people in the streets, were humming his themes from Figaro." Why is this? Why, where all the other geniuses had failed to bridge an appeal to the millions, had Mozart succeeded? Why was he the one that broke the ice and brought the tremendous electrifying undercurrent of ideas of the Enlightenment to the surface of the man in the street in terms where he was able, as Mozart himself styled, hum the truth himself to his neighbors? What is the marriage of Figaro about? Well, it's a very peculiar thing. The action of the marriage of Figaro takes place at a count's chateau in the country near Seville. Figaro has been taken into this count's service as a valet and confidential man. And at the same time the play opens, he's in love with the countess's maid, a Susanna. The count, however, no longer passionately in love with his own Rosina, as he was, but he's not completely given up his habits of gallantry, but he's turned his attention to various girls in the neighborhood. And because he is of nobility, he has the old medieval right to possess unattached girls before their marriage, and he turns his attentions to Susanna. Because he is noble, because history and tradition have decreed that this is within the rights of the nobility, he may possess Susanna regardless of her feelings. In other words, the slavery condition of mankind became poignantly focused in the opera, The Marriage of Figaro. Figaro becomes then an everyman, someone for whom anyone with feeling capacities, one needn't have too complex a philosophy of life even, could sympathize. And in that sympathy, begin to explore the feelings of outrage and revulsion that this condition could be so, and the feelings of triumph and gladness that they could be overcome. And between the outrage and the triumph, expressed with such musical precision that an experience of the marriage of Figaro utterly drains one, Mozart appeal to the senses of the millions across the face of Europe. He had been taken by his father from the age of 5 to every major capital in Europe. He was well known, and his opera spread along this network of contacts like the wildfire image that I gave previously. And Figaro enjoyed this extraordinary vogue. It summed up in one brilliant work, in one poignant experience, which people went to again and again and again, as if in getting themselves inoculated to wake up from the old hypnotic charm of the middle-aged yoke that had lingered on even to the end of the Enlightenment, and to demand the complementary experience of triumphal cure of the condition that promoted the outrage. It was a time then for the new regime to displace the old. And Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, in one fell swoop, brought the conditions to a head. 1784, and the wheels of revolution were inevitably working at this time. Mozart, at this time, composed also a series of chamber works dedicated to his fellow composer Haydn. In fact, Haydn and Mozart shared their name on the title page of six string quartets that were published in Vienna the following year, 1785. It was, in fact, a revolutionary broadside in the world of the Enlightenment, in the world of ideas, in the world of ordering musical mind and emotional experience, because the six string quartets of Haydn and Mozart are literally primers for bringing those who would hear these quartets up to a musical level that had not been achieved in the world before that time. The string quartets at this time by Mozart and Haydn initiate, in other words, a training condition for the feelings and the mind to prepare the audiences for future works that would take them increasingly where the Marriage of Figaro had only pointed, that the future works would in fact take them away from the world in which they had habitually lived and grown up from childhood, and transposed them into a visionary world that was true musically as it was mathematically, and one could experience the truth of it, the satisfaction of that world, in a feeling tone. And where the mind and feeling can go, society is not long to linger after. This new world of the mind and feeling, pioneered in the 1780s, in the late 1780s, especially by Mozart, is in fact the beginnings of the Age of Revolution. If we look for some inspirational ground that Jefferson and Napoleon and Goethe stood upon, we can find no better place, no more stable place in the universe at that time than the music of Mozart. But it wasn't a speaking platform on wood or brick. It was a mental platform of proportionate assessment of the capacities of a human being to experience, because feeling is the matrix wherein our experience orders itself. And this is why music is like architecture and a musical experience of extended complication, like a symphony or an opera, literally takes us into a new mansion of our capacity. So that when we step out of that mansion at the end of the performance, if we have really been in that mansion and understood it, the bland pall of life as it habitually presents us is no longer acceptable. We may not enter into the bland world confidently ever again. We carry with us the memory, we hum the tune, we understand the perspective that there is a new world for man to inhabit, and the message that increasingly occurred throughout Europe in the 1780s was that we shall have it regardless of who stands in the way, that man, in fact, if he is capable of one new world, may be capable of many. And so the cry, large and deafening, was for complete liberty for man, so that he may experiment with his life to see where he will go, may experiment with his personality to see what he will live, so that the experimental tone raised itself up from the prisms of Newton early in the century to the musical experience of Mozart at the end of the century, and freed Western man once and for all from the medieval yoke of serfdom and habitual hierarchy ordered according to custom and rote of the material world, freed man forever, if he will have it, to be able to be free to explore new forms of the mind and new worlds of experience and feeling commensurate with those worlds, wherever he may choose to go. And so we find Mozart is not at all the ornamental entertainer so glibly pointed to, even in our own time, by those purveyors of lies and falsehoods who style themselves as experts, professors, etc. Sorry to speak so strongly, but it is simply the case. It's better that you know all this happened 200 years ago. When we come to our own time, you will hardly believe what the conditions are today and what the possibilities might be. Mozart, at this time, found himself, through his own inspiration, somewhat freed of his family, found himself, in fact, enamored. He had been enamored with a 16-year-old girl who had finally married someone else. There were rumors that one of her sisters was getting involved with Mozart. Mozart moved to another city, but eventually came back and married Constanze. The mother of Constanze would have it that Mozart would either marry her or pay 300 florins for the rest of his life for having damaged her integrity as a young woman. Constanze, in her own letters, tore these papers up, saying that she would not fetter Wolfgang with these kinds of complications. She appears, in all retrospect, to have been a very flighty young lady. They were married. They had children. Many of them died on birth. Many of them died within a year. And as Mozart struggled with his interior world and with the exterior poverty that always hounded him, Constanze contented herself from time to time, and eventually almost continuously, to go to spas to recuperate, to have her cure. And Mozart would have to work all the harder to support her cure. And in his letters to her, urged her not to dally too much with young men at the spas. And Constanze, very happy to be seen as a loving wife, caring for her husband, but not really enjoying being around someone for whom such travail of feeling was beginning to surface increasingly, would find a reason to go off to another spa for another cure. Mozart, in the late 1780s, turned four times to the symphonic form. He wrote a symphony for the Haffner family called the Haffner Symphony. He wrote a symphony called the Linz, that city in the center of the diamond. He wrote a symphony called Prague, for the city that he loved so much. And these three symphonies show Mozart struggling with a conceptual realm that is almost titanic in its capacities and possibilities. And then we find him stepping completely outside of what would have been expected even of a genius. And his last symphony can only be described by its title, the Jupiter Symphony, that shakes man's feeling tones to a level that was only equaled by the time Beethoven got to his fifth and sixth symphonies, and has rarely been equaled since. In fact, the Sinfonia Concertante, the double concerto, was approached only a few times in human history after Mozart, once very late in the 19th century by Johannes Brahms, writing a very great double concerto. So we're talking about achievements that are almost unequaled in human history, and up to this point had never even been mooted or attempted, never even been imagined. He was exploring forms of the mind and musical expressions of them and realms of feeling capacity that human beings had never had before, on scales that were simply mountainous. Mozart was never very much physically. He was 5'4". After an attack of smallpox, he was somewhat disfigured. He was nothing to look at. He was ignored by the royalty of the time. He didn't look like anything. Skimpy, scruffy, little beggar musician who could do all kinds of prodigious things if you would pay him occasionally. One of the great pioneers of the human spirit, the tragic hero of the Enlightenment. He also, besides turning to the symphonic form, turned to the opera. He had become a Freemason. He'd been inducted into the Masonic Order, 1785, right after the triumphal surge of the marriage of Figaro. He had been given a tremendous musical chance and had written the great opera Don Giovanni, which is always misperformed. Mozart always brought in the dialogue, the heavenly spirit and the earthly spirit, the comic and the serious. And when Don Giovanni is performed even today, the light, comic, amorous level is misunderstood and misplayed, and Mozart is made ornamental. It's a nice thing to go to with your friends for a nice night out. Don Giovanni is even more revolutionary than The Marriage of Figaro. It's one of the real great works of the human spirit. He was then hard up for money, impoverished, struggling not only with the new world of musical form that he was pioneering monthly, not only with the whole new realms of human feeling which he was bringing into manifestation that had never been there before, but like all great artists, had developed a tremendous clairvoyant understanding of life itself and realized he was about to die. Realized that his days were numbered. In a letter to his father, he writes, "I have become so familiar with death that it no longer surprises me. It no longer fills me with dread. Death has become a friend, and I am on good terms with death. In that hermetic way that so few ever really understand and appreciate, man's mind and capacity make reality come to pass. Not as if there were some mechanical link, like a self-fulfilling prophecy, but that the power of man's creativity is in fact divine. He does in fact create the universe that he lives in a very real way. And even though he had to hurry and compose Così fan tutti after Don Giovanni, the opportunity came to him, 1790, to write the Magic Flute. And the Magic Flute is one of the world's greatest musical experiences. It is mystical and hermetic almost beyond belief. 200 years have made no difference whatsoever to its poignancy. I outlined the entire opera. We won't have time to go into it. I can only urge you to listen to it again and again. See performances when you can. And over a lifetime, come to an experience of the Magic Flute. While he was working on the Magic Flute, and I must say something here about Mozart's phenomenal method of composition, I exclaimed to you his phenomenal capacity, his mind, his musical prodigiousness. He did not compose on paper, he composed in his mind. That is to say, he composed his works mentally. And when they were finished in his mind, he went to paper and wrote them down, complete. It was noted by individuals around Mozart that he had composed most of his late works rather in a hurry, and that therefore they must have been light and airy and fluffy. The popular notion of Mozart is that he's fluffy, very light, light-hearted entertainment. The fact is, Mozart mooted his compositions constantly in his mind, because the mind has no limitations of time or space. Psychological time does not impugn upon the yogic powers. Mozart had an almost infinite vastness of capacity in the ordered hierarchy of his perfected enlightenment mind to essay and analyze, synthesize, and compose. And so, we find at the same time as the Magic Flute is being written, a very mysterious figure, a tall, mysterious figure, later on discovered to be an emissary of a certain eccentric count, came to Mozart's apartments in Vienna. He had taken up residence in Vienna by the 1780s. Mozart's wife was off at a spa taking her cure. Mozart was alone. The specter of death as a friend, constantly with him every hour of the day, every moment, in a continuous fashion. He was ill. He was soon to die. He was working to finish the Magic Flute, and the tall, mysterious figure came in with a commission paid in advance from the Count for a death requiem for a supposed relative of the Count. So Mozart, needing the funds, as usual, hounded by creditors, to the very last day of his life, began working on the Great Requiem. And as he approached the near completion of it, it had to be finalized and completed after his death, he began to realize that this was his death requiem that had been commissioned mystically. And the requiem and the magic flute play together. The magic flute is for the ordering of this world, of the experience in this world, in a hermetic, mystical way that, when one is acquainted with the tradition, shines like the Order of the Golden Spur would have conferred upon him, even the Order of the Golden Fleece. And the Requiem is the ordering of the other world, of the invisible realms. And so, when we enjoy the magic flute, we should also take ourselves to the Requiem, and the two works together portray for us one of the world's greatest minds at the very last extent of his efforts and capacities. He had a few friends into his apartment. They were trying to sing parts from the Requiem. Mozart was too weak to sing his part. One of his sister's relatives had come to check up on him to report back to the spa how he was getting along. Mozart urged her to stay the night. He said, "Stay one more night so that you may see me die." And the next morning, Mozart passed on. And the news of his death quickly spread across Europe. And for the few and the many, the master was dead. For the nobility, there were many other musicians to hire to compose ditties for occasions. But with Mozart, in December of 1791, with his death, the Enlightenment came to a close. The whole era . We have next week a transitional figure who lived in that realm that Mozart mastered, who rejected the Enlightenment all his life, would not be a part of it, and who was the first great genius of the Age of Revolution. William Blake.